Bruce Pratt joining us for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. We'll be talking with the author of a terrific book. We've chatted about the book a couple of times before. It's entitled Different Strokes, Serena, Venus, and the Unfinished Black Tennis Revolution. The author of the book is a communications writer and editor, a sports journalist, and also the author of a number of books, including Charging the Net, A History of Blacks in Tennis, from Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe to the Williams Sisters. We're pleased to be joined by Cecil Harris. Cecil, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me, Rich.
There's a very powerful line in the book, a number of them, but when you talk about the role of blacks in the game of tennis, and you say the status of outsider comes with the territory.
Yes, unfortunately it does. When you consider the first black person to play in major tennis, Althea Gibson, who went on to have a Hall of Fame career, was always an outsider, to the extent that while she was allowed to play doubles and mixed doubles at Wimbledon and the French Nationals, she was not allowed to play for French doubles championships in the United States, her own country, from 1950 to 1956, because the event then was held at the Longwood Cricket Club in Boston, and they simply did not invite her because she's black. So even though she was an African-American who represented the sport extremely well, won 11 major titles, 5 in singles, 6 in doubles, for 7 consecutive years, she was prevented from playing in the U.S. doubles championships in her own country. So that's from 1950. Even to today, there are anecdotal stories that I got from players like Donald Young, who still plays on the tour, talking about how a lot of black young men, for example, don't want to be the only one in the tennis club or the only one in the tennis group. So they will play basketball or go to track and field or football where they see others like them. So there's still that outsider status that prevents many young blacks from playing a sport that they may have the talent for and would enjoy.
We had Ray Arsenault on last year and talked at length about his biography of Arthur Ashe. And one of the things that he pointed out, and you pointed out in your book, is how little people understood that there was a black tennis circuit in Jim Crow times, and that it had not been for a particular doctor and some other people, we might still be swimming way back in the against the tide. And could you talk a little bit about the origins of those leagues?
Bruce. The American Tennis Association, which still exists, was founded in 1916 by influential black business men, doctors, lawyers, and what have you, to provide black people with a chance to play tennis, a chance to socialize, and spread the gospel, if you will, of tennis. And the ATA is where Althea Gibson got her start, where Arthur Ashe got his start, where Zena Garrison, a 1990 Wimbledon finalist, got her start. And basically, the ATA was to major tennis what the Negro Leagues was to Major League Baseball, with one significant difference. Once the major leagues started accepting black players like Jackie Robinson, Hank Aaron, and so forth, the Negro Leagues died. But the ATA continues to exist, and it could be a feeding ground, so to speak, for blacks and as umpires, tournament directors, tournament referees. That's sort of why the subtitle of the book is Serena, Venus, and the Unfinished Black Tennis Revolution, because there are areas off the court where blacks basically have been systematically excluded, and the ATA could be sort of a minor league for that if the tennis establishment wanted it to be. But the ATA has a rich history. It's more than 100 years old, and it's where the first two black tennis legends who are widely known, Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe, got their start.
I find it interesting that not talking about the success of black tennis players was not limited to the United States. And you quote Angela Buxton, and asking her about what the reaction was from the British press when Althea Gibson won at Wimbledon for the first time. And she said, looking back on it, it was this: if the press felt, maybe she'll go away.
Yeah, that was the unfortunate part of things. It was great that the two women found each other. Angela Buxton, the daughter of Russian Jews, who was subjected to anti-Semitism and ostracism from her white British teammates back in the day. And she found Althea Gibson, and then they became a Wimbledon champion doubles team, a French Nationals champion doubles team. But, yeah, they both were subjected to a great deal of exclusion, Althea more so, because of the racial issue. But fortunately, their friendship lasted until the end of Althea's life. Angela Buxton died earlier this year, by the way, at age 95. But it was Angela Buxton who helped Althea when Althea was destitute later in her life and basically rallied the tennis establishment to raise money for her. And as Angela put it when I interviewed her, she said, I think I gave Althea another 7 years of life.
You know, we live in an age where people like to have lists and the best ever and whatever.
Yeah.
Obviously, it seems to me no one who knows anything about the game of tennis, and I'm certainly no expert, very casual fan, would admit that Serena Williams is the greatest tennis player, at least of the last 50 years in America. And yet, you'll hear people arguing about whether it's Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan or LeBron James. We don't hear these arguments so much in favor of tennis players.
It is interesting. Yeah, you hear it more on the men's side now with Rafael Nadal, Roger Federer, but Serena Williams has 23 major titles, more than any other player in the Open era. That is since 1968. She doesn't have the all-time record for the most majors, but Margaret Court, who does with 24, won 13 of her 24 before tennis was, let's say, an above-board sport where people were not getting money under the table to appear, where it was an above-board sport with prize purses and prize money and far better competition today than there was earlier in Margaret Court's career. So, yeah, there's no question Serena is the greatest female tennis player of all time. I think she deserves more credit in that she should be mentioned alongside Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, Pele, Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, the so-called GOATs, greatest of all time. And usually women are left out of that conversation, but Serena, for all she has accomplished, deserves to be in that conversation.
Well, Serena and Venus, too, both brought an intensity that I don't know that we had seen, particularly from black female tennis players before. Did that make some people uncomfortable?
Yes, it did. And I tell an anecdote in the book. In 2002, I attended the U.S. Open semifinals here in New York, where I live. And in the first match, first semifinal, Venus Williams played a French woman, Amélie Mauresmo. The crowd was overwhelmingly rooting for Amélie Mauresmo. It was bizarre. Venus happened to win. Second match, Serena against a fellow American, Lindsay Davenport. The crowd overwhelmingly rooting for Lindsay Davenport. Serena went on to win. And then that year, Serena lost to Venus in the final. But there was an opposition among the tennis establishment to these two young girls. Like, people had the sense that Venus and Serena were changing the game, not in a bad way, but in a way that the other stars at that time could not quite keep up. And people were resistant to what the Williams sisters represented. They were more athletic, faster, quicker. But also, tennis is a thinking person sport, and the Williams sisters weren't getting enough credit for the ability to strategize, to know what shot to play at the right time. If plan A isn't working, go to a plan B. Tennis doesn't allow the kind of coaching that, you know, a boxer gets at the end of every round. You go back to your corner and the trainer is telling you what to do. Tennis isn't like that. You have to figure it out on your own. So the Williams sisters came along at a time when they represented something scary to certain fans in the tennis establishment. They didn't want the change to take place, but once it was inevitable and Venus and Serena became number one and number two in the world by 2002 and into 2003, what you hear now is that they are both revered as sports icons. They are wildly applauded when we have tennis crowds. But in the early part of this century, yeah, people were just, French woman Amélie Mauresmo, please beat them. Swiss woman Martina Hingis, please beat them. Jennifer Capriati, please beat them. That was the attitude because people were resistant to change.
I remember Michael Wilbon saying something one time on a show with Tony Kornheiser that you talk about in the book, and that's what was a systematic way, an endemic way of keeping African-Americans from becoming the officials at high-level events. And I'm wondering if since you wrote the book, if you've seen any movement in that, or does this seem to be something that we're going to be fighting for a long time?
Unfortunately, Bruce, it's still a problem. You know, there was a U.S. Open this year without fans, and I was hoping to see, well, maybe a black umpire will get a chance to officiate one of the two major finals. It still didn't happen. There have been two racial discrimination lawsuits filed by black umpires against the United States Tennis Association because the USTA decides who will sit in the high chair to officiate the most important matches, and black umpires have been systematically excluded. I write about a gentleman in the book, Cecil Hollins, who was the first black umpire to achieve a gold badge. That basically means you're qualified to officiate any tennis match anywhere in the world. Cecil Hollins, a New York native, never got a chance to officiate a U.S. Open men's or women's final in New York. Then another gentleman came along, Tony Nimmons, who achieved silver badge designation. That's the second highest level. He's also a New York resident. He never got a chance. Not since 1993, when a black woman from California named Sandy French officiated the U.S. Open women's final, has a black umpire been given the chance to officiate a U.S. Open final in men's and women's singles. It's an underreported scandal. And unfortunately, the USTA has done a good job of convincing its TV partners, ESPN and Tennis Channel, from ever bringing up the issue.
We're talking with Cecil Harris. His book is Different Strokes, Serena, Venus, and the Unfinished Black Tennis Revolution. You write a chapter about the memorable match between Serena and Naomi Osaka. What did that say about the state of tennis, but also about media coverage of the game?
Well, tennis is much more global today. I met so many. I covered that 2018 U.S. Open for the New York Daily News, and I met so many Japanese journalists who were there documenting how Naomi Osaka and the best male player from Japan, Kei Nishikori, would fare. And basically, as the tournament went on, it became clear that Serena and Venus have influenced not one but two generations of young women, not just women of color, but in the case of Naomi Osaka, whose mother is Japanese, her father is from Haiti, young women of color to want to play tennis. But what's interesting is that those young players, they idolize Serena and Venus, but they're not afraid of them. They'll go out on the court and beat them with the same kind of athletic, hard-hitting, fast and quick style that the Williams sisters popularized. And it was interesting to see that match unfold, that final. It was contentious because of arguments that went on from the second set. What was a straight set victory for Osaka, but in the second set, Serena clashed with the chair umpire over calls. And Naomi Osaka thought the crowd was booing her. They were actually booing the way the umpire officiated the match. Naomi started to cry, and Serena, being a tennis mom, now basically wrapped Naomi with in a motherly hug at the net after the match. But something else I found interesting, the Japanese journalist said to me is, they said, oh, Naomi's going to make a lot of money if she wins this tournament because she is the first player of Japanese descent to win a major title. But the Japanese journalist told me she won't make as much as Kei Nishikori because she is not, quote, pure Japanese.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, Naomi made $37.4 million last year, according to Forbes magazine. That's the most any female athlete has ever made in a 12-month period. Most of that is endorsement money. Not what happened on the court, because for the most part, there's been a tennis shutdown in 2020. So Naomi, you know, don't cry for her. She makes a great deal of money, but she should be making more. And the reason she's not making more is because she has one Haitian parent and one Japanese parent. And that shouldn't make any difference, but unfortunately, in the world in which we live, that makes too much of a difference to people who are looking for someone to endorse their products. Not everyone is on the Naomi Osaka bandwagon, even though she has a great personal story.
When you look forward, Cecil, at where we are today in tennis, assuming the pandemic ends, people get back in the stadiums, we're going to be seeing Serena near the end of her career. I don't think anybody doubts that. She's fought courageously against injury.
Yes.
How long do you think we're going to see her?
I honestly believe that next year will be the last year for both of the Williams sisters, mainly because of age. Serena is 39. She's already sort of beaten for father time, but you're quite right. She had a complicated pregnancy that left her in the hospital for several weeks after giving birth to her daughter. Before that, she had blood clots on a flight, so she's basically been on the verge of death on two separate occasions, and she's 39 in the young person's sport. Venus is 40, and Venus has not had a significant tennis victory, a title, since 2016. I think they will both play next year in the hope that there is an Olympics in Tokyo. They are the best doubles team that the Olympics has ever seen. Serena and Venus together have won 3 Olympic gold medals. I think they'd like to try it one more time. And Serena, of course, needs one more major title to tie Margaret Court's record of 24. Whether Serena gets it or not, she's the greatest player. But, you know, it's a numbers game. She wants to have 24 or 25. So I think 2021 will be the last year for them, mainly because Venus will be 41 and Serena will be 40. And this is a young person's sport.
Cecil Harris. So the book is Different Strokes, Serena, Venus, and the Unfinished Black Tennis Revolution. A tremendous read. Cecil, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Bruce, for inviting me. I'm sorry, Rich and Bruce, thank you both. I enjoy speaking with you both.